Welcome to As It Is, a 30-minute program designed for English learners. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English. We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Dorothy Gundy, Christopher Jones Cruz, Bruce Alpert, and Brian Lynn. But first, here are Dorothy Gundy and Bruce Alpert.
Mike from Florida got right to the point. Calling into C-SPAN TV Thursday, Mike said he did not like the gun control bill supported by that morning's special guest, Rhode Island Congressman David Cicilline. Where to start? First of all, it is not your job to keep Americans safe, Mike said. It is your duty to uphold the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. You are playing on people's emotions. We know what your intentions are. Mike suggested that Congressman Cicilline really wanted to take away guns from America's 100 million gun owners. Cicilline said, "That isn't the case. My most important responsibility is to keep people safe and honor the Constitution," he said. "I think you can do both things."
Doug McAdam is a Stanford University sociology professor who co-wrote a book on divided America. People are so convinced that their opinions are righteous and that others aren't just wrong, but morally suspect, he said. McAdam's opinion is that most Americans are not so divided. He said most people share moderate views on the top issues facing the nation. But increasingly, he said, the people calling C-SPAN and writing strong opinions on Facebook and Twitter are very conservative or very liberal.
After the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks on New York, Pennsylvania, and Washington, D.C., Democrats and Republicans in Congress gathered for a moment of silence and to sing God Bless America. But the response was not quite as unified after the attack on a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida, on June 12th. The gunman claimed his allegiance to the Islamic State as he killed 49 people and wounded another 53. Some Democrats walked out as a moment of silence began Monday in the U.S. Capitol for victims of the worst mass shooting in modern American history. Cicilline was one of the Democrats who walked out. He said he was angry that such events are not followed by action to make future killings less likely.
Divisions in America are nothing new. In the 1770s, there were divisions in America between loyalists to Britain and those who wanted to end English rule. From 1861 to 1865, the southern and northern U.S. states fought a deadly civil war. During the 1960s and 1970s, there were bitter fights over civil rights for African Americans and the U.S. war with Vietnam.
But there are differences in modern-day America. Paul Steckler is a professor at the University of Texas who is working on a 9-part film series about divisions in America. He said Americans watch cable TV news and read stories that support their own political views. They often live in communities where most people belong to the same political party. Robert Thompson is director of Syracuse University's Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture. He said it used to be angry Americans had fewer ways to express their anger. You could write a letter to your local newspaper, but if it got a few responses, that would be unusual. Now we all get to show how angry we are, Thompson said, "We can go on the internet and proclaim our anger to the entire world."
President Barack Obama, in his final State of the Union address in January, said one of his few regrets as he began his final year as president is continued divisions in America. "Democracy grinds to a halt without a willingness to compromise, or when even basic facts are contested, or when we listen only to those who agree with us," Obama said. The presidential campaign has only added to the divisions. Republican Donald Trump refers to Hillary Clinton, his Democratic opponent, as Crooked Hillary. Clinton said Trump is temperamentally unfit and totally unqualified to be president.
Both candidates, however, expressed their strong support for the gay community after the Orlando attack. And most Americans have also come together to support those affected by the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Spencer Cox is a Republican lieutenant governor in the western state of Utah. He spoke at a ceremony to honor victims of the Orlando attacks. He apologized for not being kind to people he went to school with who were different and whom he later learned were gay. Cox told the crowd, "My heart has changed, largely because he got to know gay people. May we try to listen more and talk less? May we forgive someone that has wronged us? And perhaps, most importantly, try to love someone that is different than us. For my straight friends, I might suggest starting with someone who is gay."
On a JetBlue flight, passengers and crew tried to comfort a woman traveling to the funeral of her grandson killed at Orlando's Pulse nightclub. As they left the plane, passengers and crew stopped to offer her sympathy. "Every single person stopped to speak to her, and not a single person was impatient at the slower deplaning process," wrote flight attendant Kelly Davis Karras on her Facebook page. There was also news coverage of people waiting in long lines in Orlando to donate blood for those injured in the shooting.
But there was one very hateful response. Roger Jimenez is a pastor of the Verity Baptist Church in Northern California. He praised the mass shooting, saying the Bible warns about homosexuality. "Orlando is a little safer tonight," Jimenez said. "The tragedy is, more of them didn't die." The Sacramento City Pastors Fellowship, representing 700 ministers, responded. They said the message from Jimenez goes against the Bible's teaching and that their hearts are broken at the cowardly act by the shooter. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Bruce Alpert.
Mikkel Mesa, a 28-year-old legal permanent resident of the United States, had not seen his family in the Dominican Republic for many years. So, in December 2013, he and his sister flew to the Caribbean nation. He said it was a week of great food and fun, with people he had not seen since he was a teenager. He returned to the United States on December 29th. When he arrived at the airport in New Jersey, he did what all so-called green card holders must do. He asked the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, or CBP, for permission to re-enter the United States. He showed the officers his green card and passport. But he was not permitted to enter. The officers arrested him instead. In 2006, Mesa pleaded guilty to possession of marijuana with intent to distribute. That is a serious crime in New Jersey. He was sentenced to community service and 5 years of supervised freedom called probation. He completed both long before he traveled to the Dominican Republic. But federal officers arrested him anyway. In 1996, Congress passed, and President Bill Clinton signed, the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Responsibility Act. The bill expanded the kinds of crimes for which legal immigrants could be expelled. Paramita Shah is the Associate Director of the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild. She said many people who have green cards do not know that the CBP can punish them even after they have served their sentence. She said, in many cases, American laws are used to expel green card holders for actions that happened years earlier. Mesa was held in a jail in New Jersey for about a year. In January 2015, he was sent back to the Dominican Republic, a place he had not lived in since he was a young boy. He said he was never told in 2006 that he could be deported after completing his sentence. Mesa had moved to the United States with his family when he was 8 years old. His parents wanted a better life for him and his sister, Genesis. "I never asked to be taken to the U.S. I never knew. We just picked up and left. But my parents were ignorant. Until this day, my mother hasn't become a citizen," he said. Mesa said he thought if he had his green card, he could not be expelled. "All I knew was I had a permanent resident card. I was living my life. I was legal," he said. He said people with green cards think they are free of expulsion threats. Brittany Young is an immigration lawyer at Catholic Charities in West Virginia. She said that is a mistaken belief held by many green card holders. "People make bad choices," she said. "They don't really quite understand the severity of their actions. That is why, honestly, I encourage people to become U.S. citizens as soon as they can." The American Immigration Council says 10% of people sent back to their countries every year are legal permanent residents. The council says 68% of that group is deported because they have committed minor or nonviolent crimes. After Mesa was arrested at the airport, his sister wrote to the Board of Immigration Appeals and the Department of Homeland Security. She asked them to reopen her brother's case. She told them about a decision from the Superior Court of New Jersey that canceled the guilty finding against Mesa in the criminal charge. Court documents show that immigration officials have refused to reopen the case. They say Mesa's family took too long to make their request. And they note, Mesa was also found guilty of lower-level crimes involving possession of marijuana. His sister said Mesa used marijuana, but did not sell it. Shah, from the National Lawyers Guild, said the 1996 law created a system that causes great pain for families. "We don't have a system with checks and balances," she said. "We don't have a system with due process. If we really want to fix and help the families who were being hurt, we need to start by appealing, or at the very least amending, the 1996 laws. Genesis said her brother is not a criminal. He was just stupid, she said. I've been trying to fight his case because we lived in the United States for 20 years. We were raised in New Jersey. He spent his whole young child, adolescence, and adult life in New Jersey. Genesis says their father suffers from diabetes. His leg was removed as a result, and he now has other health problems. She said her brother was the only person who cared for him. Mesa has been in the Dominican Republic for more than a year. He is learning about life there, but it was not easy at first. Mesa said the only work he has found has been providing customer service on the telephone. Right now, where I'm working at, I'm making less than $3 an hour working for American companies, he said. I would like to go back. I feel like it was unfair what was done to me. Not just me, many people. Mesa said the family does not have the money to pay a lawyer to help with his case. He said his sister is the only person he can depend on. We've done the best we can on our own, he said. Experts say the family could challenge the immigration agency's decision in the federal courts of appeal. Genesis said she will continue to fight to bring her brother back to the United States. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz.
The International Labor Organization, known as the ILO, has launched a campaign to end child labor. ILO officials organized a series of events to mark the World Day Against Child Labor earlier this month. Officials say child labor victimizes 168 million children worldwide. The United Nations agency called a meeting of experts to examine how businesses use children to make goods that are sold throughout the world. The meeting was held in Geneva, Switzerland. That is the Choir for the Abolition of Child Labor, a group of young people from Ivory Coast. The choir works to spread the message that children should be going to school, not working. The music set the right note for the high-level discussion on ways to end child labor. The experts said children are now involved in every part of the supply chain, from the manufacture of products to their distribution to buyers and other people. Most child labor involves goods being made for consumers in the country in which the children are working. But children also produce goods and services for export. Guy Ryder is Director General of the International Labor Organization. He says governments, employers, workers' unions, and consumers must work together to end child labor. He says companies must work to make sure their suppliers are free of child labor.
From enterprises, we need a clear message of zero tolerance of child labor. They need to know what is happening in their supply chains and to back that up with action in their business practices and dealings with suppliers. And this, I believe, is the common expectation of business in the 21st century.
Children work for low or no pay in abusive, slave-like, and dangerous conditions. They have jobs in agriculture, fishing, clothing manufacturing, electronics, and mining. Philip Jennings is General Secretary of Uni Global Union, a worldwide workers' movement. He says not enough is being done to end child labor.
There are 168 million reasons why we, as a community, cannot drop the ball and drop out of the conversation on child labor.
Jennings admits there has been progress in ending child labor. He notes that child labor has been reduced by one-third in the past 10 years. And he says governments have promised to end the custom by 2025.
The clock is running. The time for excuses from business is over. And we simply don't buy the argument that it's all the fault of government. We want business to accept its responsibility and to work with the social partners and local governments to ensure that child labor isn't a reality.
The experts agree that one way to end child labor is for adults and young people of working age to have good jobs. Some of the experts called on the ILO to write rules about how to end child labor in the complex global system that now exists. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
More Americans expect to work past their 65th birthdays and never retire, says a recent study. The Associated Press, with the NORC Center for Public Affairs Research, polled 1,075 people age 50 and older. One-fourth of them said they never plan to retire. Among low-income earners in that age group, that is even more true than for high earners. In America, the age of 65 is the traditional age to retire. 60% of people aged 50 to 64 said they expect to work past their 65th birthday. More than half of those who are already older than 65 said they plan to keep working, too. They say they are working an average of 31 hours per week. Those 50 years of age or older said finances are the most important factor in the decision to when to retire. A majority of older workers, especially those who are 65 and older, plan to switch employers or move into an entirely new profession as they head into the later years. One-third of people earning less than $50,000 a year said they will keep working. About 20% of those who earn more than $100,000 said they will never retire. As baby boomers, people born between 1946 and 1964 reach age 65, the United States general population will have more older people than ever before. The number of Americans 65 and older jumped 21%, or to 35.5 million between 2002 and 2012. That number is expected to reach 92 million by 2060. I'm Marcia James.
An Israeli company has asked the United States Patent and Trademark Office for legal rights to a process for making a special kind of human cell. The company, NanoDimension, says it uses a specialized 3D printer to create an environment in which stem cells could grow into tissue. Stem cells can develop into many different kinds of cells in the body. They can also repair damaged tissues and organs. One kind, called induced pluripotent stem cells, are used to replace tissues lost to disease or injury. The term 3D is short for three-dimensional. That means an object has length, width, and height. In 3D printing, 3D models are first created as files on a computer. The printer then uses a material like plastic or metal to create physical objects. The process involves making one layer at a time until the objects reach full form. Usually, this process is slow, but NanoDimension said it has tested a 3D printer that can produce stem cells much faster. NanoDimension is partnering with another Israeli company, Acelta, a developer of proprietary technologies to produce iPS cells. The patent application request describes the 3D printing process for making human tissues and organs. The companies have yet to produce fully functional human tissue for medical use. Amit Duror is the head of NanoDimension. He said testing has so far resulted in a proof of concept for 3D printing stem cells.
Well, we have proven that we have the ability, by combining the know-how and IP of both companies, to get to the right materials and basically being able to print very fast an array which resembles a tissue by using human stem cells.
Special ink containing living stem cells is mixed with other substances to support growth, Duror said. The goal is to create the right mixture that copies actual conditions in the human body. It's not that every layer of tissue within an organ or skin or any part of the body has just a mixture of cells, Duror noted. They are located in different concentrations in different places. Developing stem cells into lifelike, functioning tissue has long been a problem for researchers. William Wagner is the director of the University of Pittsburgh's McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine. He says 3D printing technology can be very useful.
Let's say you're looking at a drug that would fix liver disease that causes the liver to not be able to enzymatically degrade some substance. Now you have the ability to do 1,000 experiments in parallel with liver tissue, with your drug, assessing the effectiveness of it.
Wagner added that he believes production of complex human tissues, such as full organs, is still years away from happening. So 3D printing would likely be more successful in producing simpler tissues like skin or muscle, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.